Okay, good evening, everybody. Hope you're all doing well. Welcome back to the Incidental Zionists. We started a series last week where we began discussing some of the great Zionist leaders and people who are often misunderstood as Zionist leaders. Perhaps they may not be most recognized. Maybe they're the people that, when you think about Jewish history and especially modern Jewish history, these are the people that were important characters, but the big question remains on all of them: do they fall into the category of the Zionist, or do they fall in the category of the anti-Zionist who claims and who doesn't? Learning in the shul this week is graciously sponsored by Le'Nishmas Avraham Yitzchak Ben Yaakov Zev by Mrs. Zaknovitz, and I just wanted to note that at the outset. Last week we talked a lot about the Netziv of Valazh and the Rosh Yeshiva, the Valazh and Yeshiva, who clearly could not be a Zionist by the classic definition, because Zionism hadn't existed in his time. That is to say, the classic Zionist, as we discussed in the last number of weeks, classic Zionism began with the adherents of the Zionist community and Theodor Herzl. And then it lived before Herzl, so on the one hand, from a classic perspective, maybe didn't fall into the realm of Zionism. And as the Rosh Yeshiva of the only major yeshiva in Europe, he's not normally associated with Zionism, but clearly was very involved in the Chovav Eitz Yom movement. And there was a lot of Zionist underbelly inside the Valazh and Yeshiva, and he certainly didn't stop it and might have even encouraged some of its development. So, Zionist, not Zionist? That's the very popular question we tend to like to ask. We decided last week he falls somewhere in between. I want to turn to a character this week. If last week we talked about the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, next week we're going to talk about the Hasidish Rebbe, and I'll probably stick myself into a little bit of controversy next week as well. What good is a series in Jewish history if you're not going to be a little controversial, right? No, Reuven? Good suggestion, right? So this week I want to go to the Chabad Shaliach. I'm cheating a little bit calling him the Chabad Shaliach, but tonight we're going to talk a little bit about Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. It's interesting because, like the others in the character, in the characters that we'll be talking about, he was one of those people who everyone connected to, and yet at the same time, no one connects to. In other words, if you look around on Jewish community shelves in the modern era, we're going to discover that everybody knows of Rav Zevin. Everybody has a connection to Rav Zevin. Art Scroll translated parts of Rav Zevin's works. Art Scroll may have censored part of Rav Zevin's works, which we'll get to it before we're done tonight. But and he's famous for starting a certain genre that we only find in the modern era, like in the middle of the 1900s. And yet at the same time, he sort of falls between the cracks in certain things because he was somewhat of an individual. Just to give you a perspective on who he was, his own family seems to have a little bit of controversy among themselves where he fits in, because he's like so hard to fit into a box. And Zionism will be one of those boxes that will be open to understand. But a word about him. Let's start with the end of his life first. At the time that Rav Zevin passed away in Israel, he made a request that there be no hespedim said. Why? So his grandchildren asked him, Zevi, what's the big deal? What are you worried about? And he said, I'm afraid that there's going to be too much exaggeration. I won't be able to handle it. He also said on his tombstone he didn't want to have any extra honorifics because he didn't like honorifics in real life, so why should he be interested in the honorifics post-death? And he was not a small character, as we're going to see him in a couple of moments. In the Torah world, his name meant something, though very often his name seems to be a lot bigger when we add one major title that he seemed to write under most often, which was Echad Min HaRabbanim, right? One of the rabbis, as opposed to Shlomo Yosef Zevin. He didn't really like kavod. At one point in time, he was asked to write a recommendation for a certain sefer, and he wrote the recommendation, and the sefer came out, and it said, a letter of approbation, a letter of haskama from the great Rav, the leader of the Jewish community. I think they used the word Sar HaTorah, which is a term that, they used in the context of Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, who passed away earlier this year. And so when that came up, and he saw the sefer, and the sefer was brought to him, he begged. He said, "I said no honorifics, please." So he says, "Do me a favor, whatever you do, let's go reprint the entire sefer with the letter Then he says, well, that would have been too prohibitive in terms of cost. So he says, let's reprint the letter without calling me Sour Torah. I'll pay for the difference in the cost. That's how much he really wasn't into the titles. And the Chazon Ish once summed up Rav Zevin pretty clearly. The Chazon Ish was the founder of the Mayback community, certainly the leader in the Torah world in Israel in the Haredi camp. He once described Rav Zevin as saying, Rav Zevin, he doesn't recognize himself, and therefore he doesn't know exactly who he is, in terms of the greatness of the individual, the scholarship of the individual. And you're getting this from the leader of the Torah world. So you're pretty seriously underestimating Rav Zevin's importance. At the same time, while the Chazon Ish seems to represent Litvish, Orthodoxy, Lithuanian traditional, it's important for us to understand that he was a very, very clearly footed Lubavitcher. That is to say, his entire life, the Rav Zevin is identified with the Lubavitch world. In fact, the writings of the most recent Lubavitcher Rebbe, it's made very, very clear that the most recent Lubavitcher Rebbe held him in very, very high esteem, but he held the Lubavitcher Rebbe in high esteem. Let me give you a for instance. When he turned 70 years old, Rav Zevin's family and friends decided that they wanted to make a big party, and so they invited a lot of people. And they went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe to ask if this was okay, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe's like, 100%, make a big party, big stuff, right? And Rav Zevin finds out about the party because he was reading an article in the paper, and he says, an invitation to everybody, and he goes crazy, and he says, "I'm not going to this party. Like, I'm not interested in respect." And so it winds up getting scaled back to a group of 10 people after the Rebbe says, "Okay," and he couldn't fight the Rebbe. We're talking about a man who was born in 1888 in Kazmarov, which is near Minsk. His father, Rav Zevin's father, Aaron Mordechai Zevin, served as the rabbi, and he was a pretty bright child, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, our character tonight. And so at a very young age, he's told his father, as the rabbi of the town, hires a private tutor to learn with him, and they focus on two Masechtas in Gemara, right? Bava Kamma and Chulin. Just to put it into context, Chulin is the thing that separates the rabbis from the boys. Rabbis wind up learning Chulin at what, well, and here he is. He's a kid before Bar Mitzvah, and half his life is being spent on Bava Kamma and half on Chulin. Not too easy Masechtas, and he has a fluency so that by the time he makes it to Bar Mitzvah, he's fluent in these two very major sections of Shas. And his father says, "Okay, you're 13 now, so let's send you off to Mir, right? You're going off to the big Mir Yeshiva. You're going to study under Rav Eliyahu Baruch Kamai, who was the leader of the town of Mir, and also the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva, which was the sort of like the heir of the Valashin Yeshiva, which we spoke about last week." And he, while he's there, he gets very fortunate. He's paired up to learn with a chavrusa, a very older chavrusa, who is very much celebrated in the Mir Yeshiva. We'll recognize his name because he's also deserving of yet a whole Jewish history, at least night, if not week. And his name was Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Rabbi Weinberg is the author of the Sridei Eish, and he's a very fascinating Jewish history character in modern Jewish history. And so, here he is. He's this great, and he's like one of the top guys in Mir, right? And he's learning with this 13-year-old kid, right? And they're studying together. So it winds up, it's a recognition and a statement of fact of exactly where Rabbi Zevin was sort of put into context. Not only that, he also studies with Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel, which is basically like saying, "I'm studying with the boss's son," right? The Finkels are the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. So, you're talking about the leadership of the yeshiva, and he's recognized. Why? Because of his scholarship, because of his ability, and he's young. By the way, at some point during this time, being a Lubavitcher, not just a Litvish boy, he also spent some time learning under Rav Shmaryahu Noach Schneerson, the grandson of the Tzemach Tzedek. So he's also getting the Hasidus that comes along together hand in hand with the standard Talmudic style. Now, his father passes away when he's still very young, so in his early 20s, and the community of Kazmarov, comes along and they need to get a rabbi. The best way to get rabbis in the olden days was Yerusha, right? So you went to the kid and you'd say, look, your father passed away. Would you like the position? He realizes, like, I'm 20 years old. I'm not an ordained rabbi. The people want me. I'm supposed to know the town. They want to put a feather in there. What do I do? At the same time, being a rabbi was a means to help his family and be able to support his community. And so he decides on his way back to Kazmarov, he's going to get smicha. So he doesn't get smicha small. He goes to the top leaders of the day, the Rugged Shaver Gaon, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, who, by the way, has an Elizabeth connection, right, through Rabbi Pinchas Teitz and through Rabbi Pinchas Teitz's father, right, who was a rav in one of the suburbs outside, and was a brilliant, unbelievable person. The Aruch HaShulchan, who was probably the leading Rosh Yeshiva of the day, and the major posek of the day, and also the Rebbe of the Hasidic Rebbe of Bobrisk. So we make sure that, like, when he has his smicha credentials, he's covering all his bases all at the same time. And they're all looking at this kid in his early 20s, and they're like, that guy, he deserves a smicha from us. That's like saying, like, basically, the 19-year-old, you remember Doogie Howser, right? 16 years old, and he's, coming out of major medical school, and he's like, it's the same thing over here. He gets offered a lot of major pulpits later throughout Europe, but he becomes very dedicated to the people of Kazmarov. And so when the people came knocking at his door, please, will you come apply for this job? He says, I'm in the middle of building a mikveh over here in town. Like, don't bother me now. So he has a certain dedication. Later in his life, when he winds up in Israel and he realizes all these other towns and what the Nazis did to destroy the towns and destroy the rabbis first within the towns. That's the way that they used to do things. They broke the religion first on the rabbis and then later on the people. So he said, gee, I guess it's a good thing I was in Kazmarov. Nobody was interested in me. Right? He was a prolific writer. He spent a lot of time writing in all the Torah journals. And he conversed with all the people who were writing in the Torah journals. Now, remember, back then, that would be like belonging to major email groups or WhatsApp groups today. But instead of writing short, pithy ideas, he was sending out these long responses on these intricate areas of the Torah. And he's coming out as a prolific, well-recognized writer. In fact, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva of the day, Rav Shimon Shkap, who opened the yeshiva in Grodno, wrote a very famous work called the Shari Yosher. Inside the Shari Yosher is there to explain basic concepts in Jewish law. Very intense sefer. I have it here in my library behind me. There's only one shaila that appears inside the Shari Yosher. It's a two-volume work. That shaila was written by Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Right, and so in Rabbi Shkab felt it was important that you have and include this one question, and he credits Rav Zevin. That sort of tells you in the pecking order where he sits. P.S. He's in his upper 20s at this time that this is all happening, and throughout his life he's sitting and writing, and towards the end of his life he tells his grandchildren that, by the way, I want to let you know that I'm always worried that my writing's going to get mishandled or it's going to get misquoted. So, and at one point in time, he tells his grandchildren, here, I'd like you to burn these with the chametz. Please go ahead and burn this stuff with the chametz. And he said, and his children, grandchildren, are like, Zadie, please don't get rid of that stuff. He says, but I'm always worried someone's going to take it out of context. And it was valuable. There was a reason for that. In fact, so recognized was he for his writing, and he had this incredible ability. He could write about anything, and whenever he wrote, it was complete. And he had the ability to take complex topics that are interesting to multiple people, put them into a Torah twist, and do it on a very, very comfortable level. Let me give you, for instance, he has an essay in one of his Sfarim, Or HaHalacha, on snow, because it snowed one day in Yerushalayim. We'll get to that in a moment. And someone said, hey, Rebbe, we're not coming to shir unless you explain to us what's new with snow. So he sat down, thought about it, and 20 minutes later, wrote up an entire essay and delivered a full shir on all the references of snow that appear in the writings of the Gemara in the Poskim. And this became like, this would be like one small example of a classic Rav Zevin article. It's topics. He writes topically. He writes to the masses, but he always works from a perspective of intellectual honesty so that an intellectual depth that the lumdim, those who want to think on a deeper level, are there to totally benefit, which stimulates the masses as well. Well, the first person who picks up on this in a very major way is Rabbi Avram Alter of Ger. We're going to meet him next week because he's also known as the Imre Emes, and we're going to give him his own week. He's going, boy, if you think that we're controversial this week, you ain't seen nothing until we get to him next week. And he was as the Ger Rebbe, he was the very major force in Europe at the time. And as a Ger Rebbe, he has a lot at his disposal. Ger is always a very big Hasidus. And he wants to try to see, how can I get this Rabbi Zevin guy into my circles? Remember, Hasidus is not so divided into different circles, right? You get close to a Rebbe, now you're his chassid. So he's like, I want to get him into my circles. And so he decides, I'm going to get this guy to write a Hasidish newspaper, right? Something that would not be filled with other ideas. It would fit the Torah camp. It would be comfortable instead of filled with inappropriate stuff. And the guy I want, like heading this project, there were two guys, and one of them is going to be Rabbi Zevin. And so in 1915, he gets excited and he starts getting involved. Except that unfortunately, this tiny little thing broke out around that time. It was called World War I, and out went the idea after World War I. In fact, after World War I, if you remember your America, if you remember your world and global history, one of the things that happened was there were there was the rise of smaller countries. And so Ukraine, for instance, where Kasparov was set to become a republic, right? And they were trying to break free from Mother Russia, right? And become a republic. Well, Rav Zevin was selected, like the Nativ who we talked about last week. He was going to be part of the parliament, right? I take that back. It wasn't the Nativ I was thinking about. Rav Meir Shapiro, the founder of the Daf Yomi movement, was the one who was the senator in Poland in the Sejm. But Rav Zevin was also going to become a member of parliament. Unfortunately, there was a big famine that year in 17, and it sort of messed things up. And ultimately, the communists took over. It was the white Cossacks versus the Reds, and the Reds won ultimately. That year, during the big famine, Rav Zevin gets into an interesting scenario. Pesach's coming. There's pretty much no food to eat. You know what people had? A lot of beans. So they go over to Rav Zevin. They say, "Look, if we don't allow kitnios, people are going to starve to death. Like, frankly, there's not enough potatoes." And so Rav Zevin decides he's going to want to be matir kitnios, usually something only Sfardim partake of. But he realizes there's a tough spot. And he wants to do something about it. And so here he is, and he's in his low 30s at this time, and he writes to the Chafetz Chaim. So he writes to the Chafetz Chaim, and he asks the Chafetz Chaim, can you help me, tell me what to do? The Chafetz Chaim writes back, and then puts his pen down. And then he calls in an agent, and he sends an agent straight out to Kazmirov, and the agent comes to Kazmirov, and he tells Rav Zevin that I'm here in the name of the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim said he agrees with your logic. You should allow the people to eat kitnios. P.S. That year, the people in Ukraine ate kitnios in 17 due to the famine. So they later asked the Chafetz Chaim, like, why didn't you write this up? So the Chafetz Chaim said, I was about to, and then I realized that that rabbi in Kasparov is a young guy, and he's going to want to defend himself. So he's going to publish my letter. When he publishes my letter, people are going to use it in the future. To every single time they feel that they're a little bit hungry, that they're going to say, okay, I don't have to keep that kitnios anymore, and that's not the right thing to do. So I figured I'd send him a messenger. He'll be able to have the support. He'll be able to say, this is my messenger. And so it is. Well, they asked Rav Zevin about it a couple of years later, and he was absolutely right. That's exactly what I would have done. I'm a publishing guy, right? And I don't take things on my own. I'm not somebody who goes off on my own. And to go ahead, he goes ahead and he said, that's likely what I would have done. And so the Chafetz Chaim was right. I mentioned to you before that he was an ardent Lubavitcher. He was very much still in the inner circle of Lubavitch. But like I said to you before, because he was this big time writer and that was the major means of communication at the time, he also is recognized by people who are not just Hasidish or not just Lubavitch. So the Gedolim of Lita, of Lithuania and of Poland, Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, for instance, who was the person who everyone went to when they wanted to figure out how to handle social issues of the day. He was a fascinating character. He was comfortable with Rabbi Zevin. Rav Kook in Israel, right, was conversing with Rav Zevin. Other Hasidish Rebbes were conversing in writing with Rav Zevin. Now, this became a very big issue for him because as the 20s turned into the 30s, Rav Zevin decides he really needs to make Aliyah. But yet, you know, as the communists are taking over in Ukraine, he finds he's having a hard time being able to get into Israel. Well, Rav Chaim Ozer contacts Rav Kook. Rav Kook says, I'll figure something out. And magically, somehow, Rav Zevin winds up being able to emigrate to Israel together with his wife and his son and his daughter. With all that in mind, he winds up coming to Tel Aviv. And so he comes into Tel Aviv and he opens a Chabad center to help Russian refugees, just like Rabbi Kanelsky, but in Israel. Hence the title of tonight's shiur, the Shaliach, right? And in the meantime, he's still writing about everything. And he eventually moved, and the people are still coming in from Russia. And eventually he moves to Yerushalayim. And he's writing on literally everything. And he's bringing the old world into the new popular press at a period in time that people need it. So you're opening up these newspapers in pre-declared Israel, as the British Mandate. And you open up the regular Hebrew papers, and every week there's an article on Svarim, sort of like a book review that you would write, you know, maybe Reuven or something that you would see in the newspaper. But he's writing about Svarim, or he's introducing Gedolim stories, but he doesn't write the regular art scroll sanitized version or the version that we might be talking about now. No, he wants to give you a glimpse. So he tries to interpret things that he introduces you to character. Actually, one of them was the one we talked about last week. He'll give you a glimpse into the Netziv's life, but also into his style of thinking. And he gives it to you in depth. And these things are phenomenal. So he writes, they get compiled at one point. One series gets compiled into a work called Ishim Veshitos, People and Their Opinions. And he introduces you to personalities and their opinions. And you're like, wow, that makes sense. Now I understand. Why does Reb Chaim Brisker think one way and the Netziv think another way? Nobody had bothered to do that before. Today, it's very popular. Everybody does it. But in the 1930s and 1940s, nobody's doing that. He writes a famous work on Yontif. Before every Yontif, he's putting out articles, but they're not simple. On Shavuos, we light candles at this time, and then we stay up all night. No. He'll take an entire theme, and he'll write a whole article on a theme of a Yontif, all right? And he'll gather five, six, seven of those together. They're deep, but they're also written on a single topic, so they become very popular. Anyone could read it in the paper. And this is how one of his famous works, Hamoedim v'Halacha, or The Festivals in Halacha, was written. And of course, it's a three-volume work, and it came out in 1944 in its first printing. If you look at his home has people walking in, you know, all the way up to the time he passed away. Governmental leaders are walking in to get his opinion or to get source material. And at the same time, Rosh Yeshiva are walking in. And indiscriminately. And you come in, you always got a break, you got a snack, you got a water, you got a drink. And he would say, once you're taken care of, you asked him something, gave you an answer, and he went right back to his desk and he's continuing to write on the side. And this, at one point in time, he compiles another series of works, all with stories, Hasidic stories. He is, after all, a Hasidic Jew, right? So he puts out a series called Sipurei Tzadikim. On the Torah, on Navi, on the Moadim, and again he gets chided because people are like, that's not the thing you expect from a high quality rabbi, right? High quality rabbis are not supposed to tell you the Rosh Yeshiva style people. They're not supposed to be telling you stories in Maisalach. But he's and he says, but this is who I am, and that's a very big piece of Rav Zevin. This is who I am. I don't falsify. I don't fake. I'm a little of this, I'm a little of that. You're gonna put me in this box, you're gonna put me in that. It's not gonna fit. Right? And he therefore it's not a shocker that when one of the great uniters of Israel came to fruition, the project that's still going on today, but close to completion, called the Encyclopedia Talmudit, or the Talmudic Encyclopedia, the guy who oversaw the first 17 volumes was Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin in Yad Herzog. And again, it involved all sorts of people. Today, the head of that institute, Yad Herzog, and the Encyclopedia Talmudit is Professor Rabbi Dr. Avraham Steinberg. Right? You have to really rate to be able to write. And today we have the benefits of computer. When Rav Zevin was writing, we didn't. His computer was here, right up over his eyes, and he would still write. And the essays were phenomenal, and they continue to be. This is all great. This is a glimpse of who Rav Zevin was. But this is not a class just in meeting one character. We're here to get a glimpse of Rav Zevin, but I call the series The Incidental Zionist. And my question is, what are his views about Zionism? Here's a fellow who's comfortable in the black hat world. He's comfortable in the Hasidic circles. Fascinatingly, if you look through Lubavitch literature, they strongly note that Rav Zevin was not a Zionist. And that although he was at one point in time, since the Rebbe wasn't a Zionist, he deferred his opinion to the Rebbe. I have to tell you, I have a hard time accepting the Lubavitch propaganda, right? Because I don't think it's true. If by any indication, it doesn't seem to be correct. It is true, and here's another Elizabeth connection. We find in the journals of Hamodia, which were edited by Rav Eliyahu Akiva Rabinowitz, who happens to be a Rabbanit Tait's relative, right? Which therefore means he's a Rav Tait's relative as well. So inside those articles, he defends Haredi Judaism from outside forces. And one of the forces he seems to be very concerned about is the force of secular Zionism. But he was worried about the secular, not the Zionism. He was active in calling for a Beis Yaakov movement before there was a Beis Yaakov movement, because he saw in the future that without major opportunities for Jewish women, there would be a very major difficulty in fighting off the Enlightenment, which of course, dovetailed a lot of secular Zionism. So if you want to argue that he wasn't a Zionist there, we're going to have a big problem, because when he winds up in Israel, first of all, he moved to Israel. He made Aliyah. Right? He didn't go to America. He went to Israel. Usually that's a telltale sign of a statement. And he was close with Rav Kook, right? And Rav Kook was very much a Zionist. He is not an incidental Zionist. He is a clear-cut Zionist, right? We find that he, Rav Zevin, was very opposed to government interfering with the Rabbanut. In fact, there was one point in time where the Israeli government decided that it was going to imprint its opinion on top of a kashrus situation that was going on with the local rabbinate. And there were rallies that were held to oppose this. We're talking about in the early 50s. And he gets up and he delivers a famous speech that began, Ashamnu Bagatsnu. The Bagats was the governmental environment that was now trying to take over for the rabbinate, lord it over the rabbinate. So he didn't really fit very well with just standard secular overtaking religion. But that doesn't mean that I would say he's not a Zionist. When Rav Herzog, the chief rabbi of Israel, passed away, they wanted him to take over. And they said to him, if you become chief rabbi, we'll make sure nobody runs against you. And he refused, because he's in my life is Encyclopedia Talmudit now. Right? So you see, he still understood. He said, Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut. Period. There is no question about it. Nobody can whitewash that fact, right? When he used to go to shul, the Neturei Karta would throw garbage on him. Fact. There's just no two ways about it, right? He left. He said, "Ah, at least they know who to throw. I'm Zocher. They don't throw garbage at anybody. They picked me, right?" They used to laugh about it. When it came time to celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, he felt that he couldn't say that the Medina was Aschalta de Geula. He didn't have the ability to say for sure that this was the beginning of the redemption. But he said, I can't say at the same time, Lu chafetz Hashem l'hamisenu, If God really wanted to kill us off by making a state and then just using it as a means to kill off all the people, he wouldn't have let us have a Medina, and he wouldn't let us go ahead and flourish in such a Medina. So I have a hard time saying that nothing is here. If he would be living in the year 2023, I think he'd feel even stronger about that. Remember, he died, in the 70s. You look back on his life and you have to turn back and say, what he saw as flourishing in Israel is nothing compared to what we see flourishing in Israel. So I think he would be turning around and saying, yeah, Hallel, Yom HaTzmaut. He did not say Hallel with a bracha, but when the question came up, where to daven on the 5th of Iyar, he said, I'd rather be in a place where they say Hallel with a bracha than be in a place where they don't say Hallel at all. He did say Hallel with a and said Tachnun that day. And his argument was, I say Hallel on the Medina for the fact that we have a Medina. I say Tachnun because sometimes the government's not so great. So I say Hallel for the Medina, Tachnun on the Memshalah. And so they said to him, you feel it saying Hallel is the same thing as eating matzah on Pesach? Tonight's Pesach Sheni. I got to throw a Pesach reference, right? Because it's all connected. So he said, well, it's not like eating matzah, but it's certainly better than eating maror. Right? So, he had this certain style about him. Now, he was not afraid to argue whether the government had certain issues. He took the side that you have to criticize the government. So, for instance, when there was issues that came up about Shmirah Shabbos, about keeping Shabbos in places like the port of Ashdod, right? So he fought and he complained to Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, and he said, who was sick at the time, he says, listen, if you close the port, it'll send a message for their future and there'll be a source of bracha for you. You have to understand where things go. So Zionist, I don't know, I seem to think it's leaning very much in favor of very closely Zionist. At the same time, there is a certain degree, he did split. He was a unique fellow. In 48, 49, 50, he wrote an essay, or it's purported that he wrote an essay. It's a little bit debated among those who study Rav Zevin as to whether he was pro-Israeli Talmud students being conscripted into the army. There's an essay called "Al Tigu B'Mishichai," Don't Touch My Anointed Ones, that is attributed to Rabbi Zevin. And he penned it and took a very strong issue in favor of deferrals. There is an essay that also came out later that is also somewhat debated. And it too is against students taking advantage of deferrals. It's this last essay that caused a certain degree of controversy together with an essay on war in the book L'Or HaHalacha, because it advocated a position where, under the right circumstances, Rav Zevin said nobody has an excuse not to go into war. And so, if you look at the modern printings, including the one from Osada Rav Kook of L'Or HaHalacha, and they were all just recently printed. I just saw it when I was in Israel in March. In the Sfarim stores, they were selling sets of Rav Zevin's Sfarim brand new, but this essay was missing. I pointed out to my daughter, and she thought it was fascinating, right? That I knew that. I guess the old man knows something every now and then. But he did have there was a controversy as to whether he wrote that essay. Professor Mark Shapiro is a big Jewish historian and a very prolific researcher, has come to the conclusion, in his opinion, that Rav Zevin may have written the latter, but not the former. It's not so clear. The family disagrees with Rabbi with Professor Shapiro. He makes a very strong argument in favor, but I tend to trust family. That said, his family is very strongly identified today in the Haredi camp, and so therefore it's kind of hard to figure it out. Certain things can't be argued. Rav Zevin definitely is not your classic Haredi rabbi. He's a truthful individual. He's more wed to being himself and his own views than he is to being in a certain circle. So he's not going to fit, like the Nitziv, he's not going to fit the classic I'm a Zionist because I'm a Zionist model. right? At the same time, he highlights for us something very valuable and wonderful, that classic Judaism is not to fit a box. Classic Judaism is for a person to know where the boxes are, to be a person committed to halacha, to be a person to be committed to all aspects of halacha, and use them as deciding factors in life. And if they take you towards the direction of Tzionut, then you are as much and as religious as you are when they take you in the direction of Charedim or other areas. And it's possible for an individual, and for many individuals, to be able to make the peace in between. It's not a contradiction to be a Zionist and to be a full-fledged Haredi Jew. It shouldn't be. It doesn't have to be. And Rav Zevin teaches us it's not even anti-Lubavitch, contrary to the opinion that has come out in more modern times from the more modern Lubavitch press. I don't think it's true that that Rav Zevin gave up on his own Lubavitch ideas, nor that he gave up on his Zionist ideas in deference to the Rebbe. I do think it's very clear that he was an individual and who was beloved by all. He was beloved by all because he was true to himself, and he was true to himself because he was true to Hashem. And I think as a result, what we learn from Rav Zevin, and we'll continue to learn through Rav Zevin, is to put 100% into everything that you do and bring it out so everyone can benefit 100% from you. Thank you all very much. Next week we will meet somebody very, you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I had a couple questions if I can.
Go ahead.
What happened to his initial congregation in Europe? Like, what happened to that? Like, did people
Ultimately, the
move?
congregation, unfortunately, it sounds like it was destroyed. Right? It sounds, it's an excellent question. I think Kaczmarov is no longer recognized. It was never a very major town. They had a major jewel in Rav Zevin, but it was never a major town. It wasn't like those major cities of Lublin or some of the other places. It's a great question, but you'll find some history of Kaczmarov. And a lot of some of the Jews did make it to safe havens. It's not the first place that we've learned of Kaczmarov. But again, like I said, he unfortunately he was sitting in a hotbed. Ukraine was not a place to be during the Second World War.
One other thing, you referenced a sefer that like was just the one question, and it's like two volumes. What was the question that he asked generated that two volumes?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was a one question on two volumes. It generated his style of writing was to take one question for each holiday, right? One essay, sort of like what you would find today. But he would manage to wrap in every single issue of the holiday around each piece, right? So, for instance, if he was talking about Pesach, one year he might write in the newspaper about the fact that you can't eat chametz. And somehow everything about Pesach would be about how you can't eat chametz. And then the next year he'd talk about Maror, right? And then you'd read the essay and you're like, wait a second, this is all about, like, I didn't realize Maror is the entirety of Pesach. Oh, but I read last year's essay and it was all about chametz. And, he just had that style in the sefer to be able to do that. And he did this with war. He did it, with so many other subjects, snow, Shirashirim, like it would come up and you'd be like, huh? Right? But that's, you'd read it and you're like, how could I not have seen that coming? And it has that unique balance, of being intellectually stimulating, but not so covering minutiae, but at the same time being relatable by the masses to the point, like I said to you, art school translated it. Art school doesn't translate deep topics, and certainly they didn't do it in 1980 when they translated Moed v'Halacha, right? And they went ahead. What's fascinating is his Hasidic stories also have depth to them. You just have to know how to read it. And if you read his stories and why he picked each story for each pasuk, you'll be like, oh, there's depth there too, right? It's a different kind of depth. It's more of an ethical, moral depth than just a wide-ranging conceptual depth. But it's there, and he uses this all the time. It just sets you up for a deeper level of thinking that the reader who might be sitting Shabbos afternoon with a newspaper be like, wow, there's value there. Like, there's depth. You walk away fulfilled from reading the paper. It's not something you see all the time in all other environments, save of course present company. Okay. All right, everybody. I'm going to wish you a wonderful week. Next week, we meet the Imre Emes, and we are going to discover that Hasidic rabbis can be the strongest Zionists, the strongest anti-Zionists, and then at the same time, we may realize why exactly Ger Hasidim own most of Israel. Tune in next week. To have a great Shabbos, everyone.